know if Stephen knows, but his pictures are plastered all over YU right now and all the video things. The reason for that, you're very fortunate to have Rabbi Brand as the Rosh Kollel here. Also, the mensch thing I always think is the highest compliment, so thank you. But YU is about to have its Chag HaSmicha every 4 years. They have a so-called graduation-esque ceremony for the new rabbis, and they pick the best and brightest each time to speak. So the reason why Rabbi Brand's picture is all over campus is because he was the speaker at the last Chag HaSmicha, so they simply have a photograph from that. So it's really a pleasure seeing you reconnecting in this capacity, and particularly with regards to Tanakh. I also can't start any shiur without thanking all of you both for coming and for being part of this. And it was such a treat to hear Rabbi Myers, you know, getting to know you. You're hiding all the way back there. You don't think I could see you. But the fact of the matter is, I've really enjoyed my association with the Ida Crown Academy and speaking to you over the years. It was such a treat to really hear you in action, which is the first time that I've ever had that privilege. You're so fortunate to have him as local talent. I'm going to try to talk about this chop the baby in half story. I have till 11 o'clock is my end. I just want to make sure I have that straight, because pacing is everything. I tend to speak very quickly, and I try very hard to curtail that, but I fail. So just that you're aware. The chop the baby in half story is a very famous story, to put it mildly, and it's one that's we have a term, Solomonic wisdom, which we tend to bandy around as a result of the story. I wanted to start by plunging into the medieval philosophical world, just for the sake of it's a really cool point, and then we'll drag back out to the biblical story, which is, of course, what we are here to do. So you all have your text in front of you. I have the Hebrew, which is what I'm going to be reading from and translating, but you also have an English translation on the back if you'd rather follow that, whatever you prefer. But I'm going to be doing it in the Hebrew with translation. This is the one God comes to Shlomo in a prophetic dream and says, I will give you one wish. What would you like? You've done such wonderful things and given so many privileges to David, my father, including that his son, me, is on the throne. I'm so inexperienced, I'm young, how am I supposed to be able to govern this great nation? It's a huge nation, bless us. I wish that the people of Israel can always say about our population how huge we are, but Shlomo at least felt in his day that that was the case. God, please give me a wise and discerning heart that I should be able to govern these people fairly, because who can do it without divine help? God is very impressed, as of course are we the reader, even before getting narrative confirmation that God is impressed. I'm like, wow, you have one wish and you're going to ask for wisdom. How impressive. It's already probably the wisest thing that Shlomo ever did, is what he did before he got the divine wisdom, right? The fact that he had the wherewithal to be able to pick this one wise thing right away, it's remarkable, and God is duly impressed. Since you didn't ask all the normal stuff that people might ask, okay, you get it. Nobody before you will have ever been as wise as you will be. Never again will somebody rise to be as wise as you are. And this is God speaking. This is not a person. Very often you know the rule. If God or the narrator speaks, that's objective truth in a biblical narrative. And if a person speaks, it still might be right, but people are people. Biblical people were people as well. They might be right, they might not be right, they might be trying to be polite. So if somebody were to come to Shlomo's court and say, Shlomo, you're the wisest ever, we'd say, this person has very good manners. But we wouldn't say doctrinally, this is the wisest person ever. If God is telling Shlomo in a dream, you're going to be the wisest one who ever lived, okay, so Shlomo is the wisest one who ever lived. Legam, pasuk yedgimel, gam asher lo sha'alta natati lach, not only that, you're going to get all the other stuff that you could have asked for. Great. And if you are faithful to the Torah and to my word, then you will live a long time as well. He wakes up and behold, it was a dream. Makes a big feast because after all, this is terrific. All right, let me just ask you. According to this biblical narrative and according to God's promise to Shlomo, was Shlomo the wisest person to ever have lived? Yes, yes. Anybody going to disagree? You shouldn't. Yeah, okay. We have a dissenting voice in the back. Good. Thank you. You raise an interesting point. Biblical dreams tend to have this fuzzy, especially in the Yosef narrative, is a good example where it's not quite prophetic, but it's kind of close. And therefore, the interpretive element is part of the story. In this case, this seems to be what we would think of as a prophecy. Even though prophecy and dream in Tanakh are a part of the spectrum, rather than two entirely different things, which causes confusion sometimes. From that vantage point, the standard biblical read is what most people are saying, but your point is still a good caveat. This is a prophetic promise that Shlomo should be the wisest person who ever, ever, ever should live. And in fact, all of our commentators but one assume, but you're all nodding your heads. It's like, come on, you're asking such an easy question today. They'll get a little tougher. But for the time being, it seems so obvious. One medieval commentator, Ralbag, Rabbi Levi ben Gershon, 14th century Provence, he was tormented by this verse. Not because of the dream problem. He was tormented for two different reasons. And then I'm going to pop in, this is the setup for what I think is the third reason. But here are the two big reasons. One is that Ralbag was one of the great Jewish philosophers. And he believed, like Rambam, that the greatest philosopher is the greatest prophet, or the greatest prophet has to have been the greatest philosopher. They're not different tracks. Not like you have the spiritual ones and then you have the intellectuals. No. The greatest prophet, by definition, has to be the wisest. Well, who was the greatest prophet ever? Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore, he must have been the wisest. If that's the case, then Shlomo can't be the wisest because he wasn't the greatest prophet ever. He was a prophet of sorts. He is very wise, but you cannot say that. Plus, Ralbag is just intellectually bothered. Is it possible that nobody else came along? Maybe even somebody like Ralbag, and I don't mean that in a critical way of Ralbag. He finds it very hard to believe, and he says this explicitly, that nobody else should arise that's as wise as this. And therefore, he says, that what God is promising Shlomo is that he should be the wisest of his own generation, and maybe, let's be generous, the generation before and the generation after, and that's it. Maximum three-generation window that Shlomo is the wisest ever, which is still, by the way, it's pretty good. But it's not nearly as grand of a claim as the wisest human being ever, ever, ever to walk the planet from Adam HaRishon to now and beyond. And Ralbag is limiting this because of philosophical considerations. But I'm going to throw out a third reason that could have motivated Ralbag, even though he doesn't say this particular point, but most of our commentators are bothered by a different question. By way of proof, how do we know that Shlomo is the wisest ever? We have this great chop the baby in half story. Solomonic wisdom at its finest. Right? Shlomo has these two women come in there, and you know the story, but I'm going to paraphrase it anyway, and if I'm missing any important details, you're going to get me for that, okay? Shlomo sees these two women, and you know, there's a baby there. One woman says, well, you know, she tells the whole story, and we'll read it inside shortly. In fact, why shortly? Let's read it now. Az tavona, pasuk tezayin, it's better to actually see the whole story and then we'll be able to backtrack. Shtaim nashim zonot el hamelech v'tamod lefanav. These two prostitutes come before Shlomo and they stand in front of him as in trial. V'tamer ha'isha ha'achat, who later on is going to be given a name by me called woman number one. Okay? But for the time being, let's just go with the flow. Bi'adoni, O Lord, with a lowercase l. Ani v'ha'isha ha'zot yoshevah b'vayit echad, we both live in this same house. V'eled ima b'vayit, we both gave birth to sons. And after 3 days from my child being born, nobody else lives with us, just the two women, you know, subletting an apartment. We each have a son. Woman number two over here, her son died because she rolled and she didn't, you know, have the good safety devices that we have today. She just slept with the infant in bed and she rolled over onto this baby, suffocating her own son. So she woke up and realized what happened, so she exchanges the infants. She switched the baby. She gave me the dead one and took the live one for herself. And I woke up to nurse my son. And behold, the baby is dead. And when it got light, I'm a mom. I recognize my child instantly. I know every last nook and cranny. I know which, you know, what the nose looks like and all of that. And this wasn't my son. Now woman number two finally chimes in. That is not the case. In fact, my son is the living one and yours is the dead one. The Zotomeret, woman number one strikes back and says, Lo, no, it's the opposite. And they continue to speak on like this. He reiterates their arguments. And then comes the classic move. Bring me my sword. And they bring out a sword. And of course, you can just imagine, the bummer is, if you know this story, it's not as dramatic, right? But the first time you're reading this, you're like, what's he going to do? And of course, in the court case, I like the way it's set up. He doesn't say what he's going to do with the sword. So there's actually a time delay here. And it's important to at least appreciate this moment where the whole court, you know, is all abuzz. Like, what in the world is he going to do with that sword? This isn't a sword case. Maybe ask them some more questions. I don't know. By Yomar HaMelech, and finally the sword comes out. Yizru et hayelad achai lishnayim, v'shna dachatzi l'achad v'dachatzi l'achad. Cut it in half and give half of the baby to each one of the mothers. So the classic response, the real mother says, no! That's my baby. Here, give the baby to her. It's fine. Just don't chop them in half. And the other one's like, sounds fair to me. What a great deal. We'll each get half. I call the head. You know, whatever it's going to be. And Shlomo, with his dramatic flourish, still make this, I'm a lefty, so I always do it like this, but we all know that Shlomo must have been a righty. So with the dramatic flourish, I try so hard. And but anyway, and of course, right away, the town is all abuzz, and before you know it, headlines all across the country are saying, wow, Shlomo solved a case without witnesses. Very good. And right away, this story is visibly by way of proof that Shlomo is divinely ordained wisdom. And many commentators say that this pasuk finishes the point that he has solidified the kingdom by proving his wisdom. All right. Now, I set up Ralbag's medieval philosophical discussion, which, of course, receives many objections, including by Abarbanel, who says, this is divinely given wisdom. So who says that it follows a system of philosophical axioms that Ralbag or Rambam or whomever is imposing onto the text? Maybe Moshe was the greatest prophet, and maybe Shlomo is the wisest ever, and that's fine. You don't need to link the two. Ralbag is wrong. That's a medieval Jewish philosophy debate. But Ralbag's issue of saying that Shlomo's wisdom is only the greatest for his generation and perhaps the one before and the one after solves a different problem that plagues our commentators, and I'll just toss it out to you as plainly as possible. This is a very intelligent solution, of course. Shlomo HaMelech, without any witnesses, it's one woman's word against another, is able to find that insightful move that breaks open the case, and we're all very proud of him. But honestly, is this really the wisest thing that you've ever seen? It's wise, it's intelligent, it's Solomonic even. Is this really the... I've seen brain teasers that are harder than this. I love brain teasers. And when you can solve some of the toughies, I'm way more impressed, frankly, than this. And a lot of our commentators were actually really bothered by this problem. Because most don't accept Ralbag's reading that it's just the generation before or after, although notice he fixes everything by saying that. But realistically, the text is saying Shlomo has divine wisdom and is the wisest person ever to live and ever who has lived and ever who will live. Is this really the wisest ever? And that's a good question. I like good questions. And this is one that particularly plagued our commentators because you'll see a certain circularity. What I wanted to do for this shiur is simply map out the history of interpretation with different plans and then try to set forth a different approach that might be able to work it out. Some of the medieval halachists, what we call the Rishonim on the Talmud, are so bothered by this story and by this question that I'm asking that they suggest actually what the most important part of the story is what's not even here. It was actually a very subtle halachic argument about levirate marriage, which ties right back into Rabbi Meir's shiur about Yibum, levirate marriage with Yehuda and Tamar. In fact, these two women are not just saying, no, it's mine, no, it's mine. They're arguing over the most difficult points in Masechet Yevamot. And so these medieval rabbis begin to try to work out these very complex, difficult, and truly brilliant solutions to this problem. So a couple of points are in order here. One, that's obviously not what our narrator is trying to teach us, right? If you're going to be a Pashtan and try to understand what the Sefer Melachim want to teach, the answer is not Masechet Yevamot. Masechet Yevamot wants to teach us Masechet Yevamot. And B, just for the record, any rabbi who comes up with that brilliant solution in Masechet Yevamot is by definition as wise as Shlomo. It's a circular reason. They obviously have worked out all of these points, and so the fact that Shlomo did first doesn't make him the wisest ever, it simply makes him on par with these medieval rabbis. So those are two objections that leave the world of Pshat behind. But then in the world of Pshat, you're going to hear some really interesting stuff, by the way, today. You're going to fly me all the way to Chicago, you're going to get the best. So Rabbi Yosef Kara, not to be confused with Rabbi Yosef Karo. Rabbi Yosef Karo wrote the Beit Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Yosef Kara was a younger contemporary of Rashi in northern France. And he was plagued. How could it be that Shlomo is considered the wisest of all just for bringing out a sword? It's smart, it's intelligent, kudos to him. It's not the best ever. Well, it must be, and he starts a whole new trend in our Parshanut, it must be that he figured out the truth teller before the sword came out. You thought the sword was the kicker. Nope, that's not brilliant enough. But if he could figure it out before the sword came out, wow, that's impressive. So how did he do that? Well, after all, woman number one said that she gave birth 3 days before the other one. So Rabbi Yosef Kara is going to make the following set of assumptions. One, actually, both babies were in the room, the living one and the dead one. And an infant that's 3 days older looks different from one that just came out. And therefore Shlomo, while he's busy trying to figure out what to do with this one-on-one, gives a quick glance at the babies, realizes one looks more developed, so to speak, than the other one, concludes, based on that, who the truth teller is and who the liar is, and then brings out the sword simply to prove to everybody else what he already knew. What do you think of that? It's really cool, right? You start to see that I have a good question for you today. That's when you have answers like this, you start seeing a good question. Because there's nothing in our story about Shlomo looking at the two babies. In fact, we have no reason to understand that the dead baby is in the room. Why is Rabbi Yosef Kara doing this? Because he's bothered by our problem. He's bothered by, is Shlomo really the wisest ever? Abarbanel suggests differently. In the earlier shiur, it was Abarbanel, now he's Abarbanel. These are two classic pronunciations to his name, and there are good reasons to follow either one. For the time being, I call him Abarbanel. And so he thinks that it's very similar to, I don't know if you've ever been on jury duty, but they love me. I'm on different lists, they call me all the time, and I've served on a few trials, and I've called them, I'm not that old, but I've really come down every single time I'm up for eligibility, they call me, and they call me many times before that, and I have to tell them I'm not, can't get me yet. But then they know. When you go down there, I have not such a good memory. I depend on notes, and that's the way that I tend to work. But they made it very clear that you're not allowed to take notes during the trial. Why is that? Even if you don't know the rule, why does it not make sense to take notes during the trial if you're a juror?
Confidentiality.
Part of it might be confidentiality. You don't want to leave the courtroom with any information. Part of it is that they want you to be good jurors. What's going on? If you're writing down this sentence, that means you're not listening to the next one.
Right.
If you're looking down at your notebook, that means you're not watching their body language. You're not paying attention to their facial expressions. You're not paying attention to their inflections. You got to look right at the juror, and you have to take in the entire experience. So what I did is every time there was a break, I wrote down as much as I possibly could, because I was afraid that over a 3-week trial, well, I've been on several trials, but this particular one was 3 weeks and very convoluted. I'm glad I did that. It was confusing. And there's no way I would have remembered anything had I not taken these notes. But in the meantime, I liked the rule. And Nechama Leibowitz, by the way, of blessed memory, didn't allow her students to take notes. So the one time I had the privilege to take a course with her, and she immediately announced that, same rule. If you're writing down this sentence, then you can't pay attention to the next sentence. But we really wanted to take notes, so we all hid our notebooks under our desk. You know, so instead of comic books, we were really just taking notes on what she had to say. We were afraid that we might forget some of it. But I liked what she said as well. Abarbanel says the same thing here. Shlomo was busy paying attention to their body language and the way that they spoke, and he was able to tell from their language and from the way that they spoke, one of them seemed more nervous than the other one. And so he says, aha, I know the truth teller from the liar. And once again, he brought out the sword to prove that which he already knew. And therefore, everybody's like, wow, that's incredible. From that point of view, it's brilliant. But again, according to either one of these interpretations, we have the same set of problems. One is, there's nothing in our text about body language or about two babies in the room or about the fact that he's looking either at the two babies or at the two women and making these determinations from that. And also, once again, is that really the wisest person ever? Yes, you could be a very perceptive person and really be able to take in body language and inflections, and it's good. It's a very fine talent to have. It's good for all kinds of professions, not only king. But the fact of the matter is, it's not enough to clinch this is the wisest person who ever lived. What I like about those interpretations is that they bring us, A, into the text, sort of, and they're making us try to figure out, can we figure out something that's super ultra brilliant from within the narrative itself rather than from Masechet Yevamot. So it has a major advantage over the first line of interpretation. Then comes the third line. Third line of interpretation is espoused by Rabbi Yosef Ibn Kaspi, who also is in 14th century Brabant, and later picked up by Rav Yehuda Kiel in Dat Mikra. They say maybe the narrative itself tells us the answer. After all, woman number one, who speaks, she speaks clearly and cogently, and the narrative gives her a lot of space. We read her arguments. She just says very clearly what must have happened. And woman number two, all she has to say for herself is, Lo, ki b'niha chai v'necha meh. No, my son is the living one and yours is the dead one. Rabbi Yosef Ibn Kaspi is not impressed with woman number two. Woman number one sounds so reasoned and so careful and so set up, and the second one just is a little outburst. And Rabbi Yehuda Kiel agrees that from the narrative itself, you can argue that we are told who the truth teller is. In other words, we know by the end of the story, the woman who says, please don't chop the baby in half, we know that that's the right mother, just what Shlomo says. You didn't need Shlomo to figure that one out. But we don't know which woman that was. Was that the first woman who spoke or the second one who spoke? According to Rabbi Yosef Ibn Kaspi in the 14th century and Rabbi Yehuda Kiel in the 20th century, we know exactly which woman is telling the truth, namely the first one. Now, you understand, though, that within this approach, the narrator is telling us something. We don't know that this is a full transcript of the court dialogue. We only know that this is what the narrator is choosing to tell us for eternal value. So the fact that woman number one goes long and woman number two goes short doesn't prove that woman number two really went short in the court case. We just know that the narrator would be setting it up for the reader. That's point number one. Point number two is Abarbanel's objection to Ibn Kaspi. He says, what is left for woman number two to do? Woman number one makes this very nice, reasoned case about what happened, but she is lying, according to woman number two. I'm not taking sides on this issue at all. But at the very least, Abarbanel notes correctly, woman number two has very little left to say. She doesn't have to come up with a different story. The different story is, you're lying. I don't know how your baby died, but your baby died. This is my baby, and that's it. There's nothing more for me to say to rebut you. So rather than considering her voice unreasonable or outburstish or anything like that, she's just saying all that there is left to say. And from that point of view, this Ibn Kaspi Kiel position might work and at least has the severe advantage of it's coming from our text. It's in the text, but it's not at all clear that this is what the text is trying to convey. It's not until the 19th century that woman number two finally got a fair hearing, and that is by Malbim. If you go back to Pasuk Kaf Bet, Malbim makes a case that woman number two is the truth teller, meaning woman number one says this very long speech. Now, woman number two says in Pasuk Kaf Bet, "Batomer ha'isha acheret." This is woman number two. Lo ki b'niha chai u'b'necha med. V'zot omeret, woman number one responds, Lo ki b'necha med u'b'niha chai, v'atidaberna lefneha melech. So they're both saying the same thing, right? No, they are not. What's the difference?
First, he mentions her own son first.
Not only her own son, but the living one. Yes. Very good. Woman number two stresses, the living one is mine and the dead one is yours. And the first one is saying the dead one is yours and the living one is mine. Now, basic psychological principle which interpreters throughout the history of Tanakh have used is, what's really on your mind is the thing you say first. So if you're saying the living child is mine and the dead child is yours, that's what we would think of as a very normal mother. If you're saying, if a woman is coming to say the dead one is yours and the living one is mine, that's very strange. What mother is going to think about the other child before she thinks about her own child? And in fact, Malbim argues further that this Batzda Berna Lifnei HaMelech means that they continued this circle. It might be that if this dialogue happened only once, then it could be that woman number one is simply trying to rebut woman number two. But if this continues to go, where woman number two keeps on saying, the living one is mine, the dead one is yours, and woman number one is saying, the dead one is yours, and the living one is mine, Shlomo knows a couple of things. One, he already knows who the truth teller is. It's woman number two, because she's obviously focused on what a normal mother would focus on. But he knows something more than just that woman number one is a liar. Woman number one is a sicko. Because after all, if her emphasis is on death, that means that I could probably pull out a sword, and I'll bet she's going to even say, yeah, chop it in half. Because after all, not every liar is willing to watch a baby get chopped in half in front of her. How does Shlomo know that his sword move is going to work? According to Malbim, we have an answer. That this woman number one is so death-obsessed that she'd be willing to see a living baby get whapped in half. Oh, sorry. Whapped in half, right in front. I really do try. It is shtick, but I actually do try to do it with my right. But in the meantime, that's how Malbim understands the story. And from this point of view, woman number two is the truth teller, and woman number one is the liar. And once again, Shlomo knew before the sword came out, right? They're all trying to find some means of brilliant interpretation. By the way, one more support for Malbim is that in Pasuk Kaf Gimel, when Shlomo reiterates the arguments, he keeps their order. Shlomo perfectly heard what they were saying. And he realized, everybody else in the world heard, everybody else was sitting there in the courtroom, and in fact, every Jewish interpreter until the 19th century when Malbim said this, all the parab would paraphrase this dialogue as saying, no, it's mine. No, it's mine. And then that's just going back and forth without any care to the order. Malbim perceptively picks up on the order which the narrator himself seems to be concerned with. So here we have a huge advantage in that it's a text-based argument. It plays off of the order and a psychological principle. It even helps explain how Shlomo was convinced that his sword gamble would work. And it explains the next pasuk, where Shlomo in fact reiterates exactly this formulation. No earlier commentator was concerned with this order. Now you have to at least ask, our commentators are very smart, and they notice everything. They really, really, really do. How could it be that nobody before the 19th century picked up on this very, it's a very convincing argument? The answer is that Malbim himself had to hem and haw with it. What I mentioned before, that he was bothered by Batzda Berna Lifnei HaMelech in Pasuk Kafbet. Malbim was concerned, if it only happened once, it might be an element of rebuttal. Okay, well then that means maybe the narrative is doing that. Why would it, in contemporary English, we would refer to this as a chiasm. It's a poetic form that's used throughout biblical literature. A, B, B, A. Rather than just saying the same thing the same way, the first woman would say living dead, and the next one would say dead living. It doesn't mean that woman number one is a sicko. Woman number one, or at least the narrator, is just being a good poet. There's nothing dramatic about this particular argument at all. Woman number one is not crazy. Woman number one is not death-obsessed. Woman number one might not have even said it this way. This is simply good biblical poetic form. It appears everywhere, both in Psalms and in narratives and everywhere. And from that point of view, what would the chiasm achieve? It would achieve a circularity in the argument. It would really mean, no, it's mine, no, it's mine. Exactly what everybody before Malbim thought. From that point of view, we can't know. If it's a chiasm, then we can't, you and I cannot know, is it woman number one or woman number two? Rather, we're stumped. We all think, oh, we can solve this, because the narrator is bringing us into the story. The narrator is saying, Dear reader of the biblical text, come to this courtroom. Here are the women, here are their arguments. See if you can figure this out. And we're like, I could do this. I read mystery novels. I'm with you. And I'm ready to solve the case. And by the end, I realize, man, it's one woman's word against another one. I can't trap either one of them. And then Shlomo comes up with his brilliant argument with the sword and poof, wins the day. So let's summarize what we have so far. Possibility A is that there's some external to the text solution. And by definition, that means it's external to the text. We don't like those answers. If you're trying to understand what the text is all about, external to the text does not work. Within the internal to the text camp, you have three approaches so far. One is, Shlomo was brilliant enough to realize that woman number one was very reasoned, and woman number two was not so reasoned. That's the Yosef Ibn Kasti, Yudakil approach. The downside of that is, what did woman number two have left to do? It's really, and again, is that really so brilliant? Malbim argues, woman number two is the truth teller, because she was interested in life, and the other one was obsessed with death. If this is not a chiasm, if this is really a perceptive comment on Shlomo, then I think Malbim is right. And I think he really has the best textual compelling argument of all. But that leads to the if part, which is the other if is maybe he's not right. And this is a chiasm trying to show the circularity of their argument. And in fact, you and I will never understand, was it woman number one or woman number two? But therefore, we, like the ancient Israelites, can be impressed that Shlomo HaMelech figured it out with the sword trick. And that's the point of the story. To this day, you should just know, I summarize the traditional parshanut, to this day, articles continue to be published on this essay, on this parak, as well they should be. And to this day, there are defenders of woman number one is the truth teller. There are defenders of woman number two is the truth teller. And there are defenders of the narrator will not let us know which one is right. Mm-hmm. To this day, these three arguments live on, which of course to me just heightens the brilliance of Shlomo HaMelech, because we're still stumped. What I wanted to do in my remaining 15, 20 minutes is to propose an alternative that might actually solve the problem from an entirely different angle. And that is, we're misdefining what wisdom is. All of our commentators so far are assuming that Shlomo's solution was the smartest solution. But maybe that's not what biblical chokmah is. Yes, he's very smart, but this is not simply solving the hardest brain teaser ever, or solving a tough physics situation ever. Chokmah in Tanakh includes intelligence, but it also includes good religious sense to do the right thing. It includes being just. If you read Sefer Mishlei and Yirah Chacham, it's not about who the most brilliant person in the class is, but the straight-A average. It's all about how you live a good, sensible religious life. And from that point of view, I think the reason why we get caught up in these three options, which again continue to circulate through scholarly literature, is all rooted in a misdefinition, or only in a partial definition, of what biblical chokmah is. Let's give it one last look in our narrative. If you look at Pasuk Tet Vav, Vayikach Shlomo, this is at the end of the dream, Vine chalom, vayavo Yerushalayim, vayamod lifnei Aron berit Hashem, vayal olot, vayashlamim, vayaz mishelech ol vadav. Shlomo wakes up, and it was a dream. He goes to Yerushalayim and stands before the Ark of God. Pasuk Tet Zayin says, az tavona, just like Shlomo vayavod to Yerushalayim, so they tavod to Shlomo. Shtayim nashim zanot elamech, vatamodna lifanav. Shlomo stood before the Ark, and now these prostitutes are standing before Shlomo. It is obvious that our narrator wants us to link these two narratives, and therefore he's using the exact same words to tie them together. That's point number one. And that's the idea of what I mentioned before, that one is the dream and the and request of wisdom, and the second story is by way of proof, just to make sure that there is no ambiguity about this. Now, these two narratives may be connected, but what is Shlomo called in each one of these narratives? He's consistently called one thing in the first half, and he's consistently called a second thing in the second half. Okay, a little louder.
In the second, he's called Hamelech.
Second, he's called Hamelech. Very good. 10 times, by the way. It's a very short paragraph over there. 10 times he's referred to as Hamelech. And in the top?
Shlomo.
So why is he Shlomo in the first paragraph, and he's Hamelech in the second paragraph?
The first paragraph, he's talking the Shemistra. He's not a king. He's just not a human being.
Very good. When you stand before God, God is Melech Malchei HaMelachim, and nobody else is a king. He's Shlomo, just like we're us. Right? It's purely democratic. So everybody is nothing next to God. Well, in the second paragraph, what's happening? He is HaMelech. Now, he is the one who is in charge rendering justice. And here's a detail that not a single one of the commentators that I've mentioned picks up on. All of the commentators are talking about a story between two women. Between two mothers. But what are they? They're prostitutes. Why mention that detail?
You can't trust their testimony.
Oh, so part of it is very good. Prostitutes are not necessarily the most ethical, upright people in any society. And therefore, the fact that they're lying means that they're particularly good liars. You couldn't, the body language and intonation argument of a Barbanel becomes weakened by the fact that they are prostitutes, actually. Very good. That's one element of this. Why else?
It also explains why they can't bring anybody else, they can't bring a father to
Very
support
good.
Their argument.
Very good. That there are no men in their world. Well, there are lots of men in their world, but there are no men that live with them in the house. And that's a crucial part of our narrative. The idea is that's why they're saying there are no witnesses. We live together in this house. There was no man with us in the house except for us in the house. House. And there's no question that their choice of vocation has a lot to do with the lack of testimony, and potentially also the lack of honesty. What I would submit is that there's a third component on top of those two, and that is, in any society, prostitution is the lowest rung of anything. In a society where Shlomo HaMelech is a prophet, and he's minutes away from building the Beit HaMikdash, it's a gazillion times lower. Right? In other words, of all people in the world to troop into this wonderful king's palace, ugh, two prostitutes just come right into this holy man who just received prophecy, surrounded by this righteous country, the most righteous in Israel's history, it's really at the doorstep of building the Beit HaMikdash. And these two prostitutes come in here and start bickering over, no, it's mine. And you know what? Shlomo listened to them like he would listen to anybody else. They had access to the palace. They were the lowest of the low. They were probably great big liars. And Shlomo said, you know what? Nobody else can solve this case because there are no witnesses. Lower courts could not handle a case like this. Presumably, the case didn't just go right to Shlomo's palace. Presumably, it went through the court circuit. And all the judges said the same thing. Are there any witnesses? No. Okay, well then, case dismissed. What are we supposed to do? It's one woman's word against another woman's word. And eventually, it worked its way up to the ultimate judge in the country, namely HaMelech. And Shlomo says, you're welcome. And I'm going to listen with total intent and care to your words. I don't care what you are. That's impressive. This is fairness. And this starts to say something about what chokhmah, what divine wisdom is. Shlomo was fair. And just as everybody stands, to your point, when Shlomo is standing before God, he's Shlomo. When people are standing before the king, they're all citizens. It doesn't matter who's in front of you. You have to be able to judge with absolute fairness. In fact, the Torah has a remarkable word to describe courts. And if you look at source number one, if you turn to page 3, talking about the Eved Ivri who for some sick reason decides he wants to stick around rather than going free after 6 years. V'yishah Adonav el ha-Elohim. He's brought to ha-Elohim. V'yishah el ha-Delet ha-Mizizah v'atzah Adonav et ha-Oznav ha-Marsav ha-Vado le-Olam. So what is el ha-Elohim? Courts. How do you... Why would it, doesn't Elohim mean God? It does mean court, because presumably, you know, it's not that God is going to show up with an awl and whap a hole in the Eved Ivri's ear. Presumably, he goes to a court and he's pierced with an awl over there. But why is the court called Ha Elohim? So Ibn Ezra says, source number 2, Hema Dayanim, exactly what you are saying. Behema Kohanim, O Ashafatim Shehem Hamelachim, Ki HaTorah B'Yad HaKohanim, Mishna HaTorah B'Yad HaMelech. V'nikru'u Elohim. So why is the court called Elohim? Kihem pekidei Elohim ba'aretz, because they're God's agents. That is high discussion of a court. And you really, you look at this with trepidation. I remember having to argue this very strenuously on multiple jury duty cases where a lot of my co-jurors just wanted to go home. So I didn't bring up Ibn Ezra on this. Or I figured I would spare them of that detail. But I came in there trembling. It's like, you know, the 3-week trial, that it was a murder trial. It was hardcore. It was a very traumatic moment in my life, just because it wasn't Masechet Sanhedrin. This was a real guy. And he was a lefty too, one might add. But in the meantime, there's a real guy, and I'm looking right at him, and I'm busy discussing with these other 11 people, is this person going to be behind bars for a very long time to come? Answer, I sure hope he's still behind them, or not. And it was a very traumatic moment. And I had this Ibn Ezra and this Pasuk right very much in my head. We're playing God here. We're occupying God's role. God is not going to swoop in with a lightning bolt and smite this guy. It's up to us to render fair justice, and we better give this a very good deliberation before we get out of here, even if that means a lot more of our time, which is what it ended up being. So that's what Ibn Ezra is trying to say. This is a very strong statement that the Torah makes, that as far as the Torah is concerned, justice, human justice, is a God-like prerogative. And yes, God has entrusted people to do that, but we should realize the severity of that justice. It's very easy to imagine that somebody like Shlomo, who is rendering God-like justice, if he weren't as amazing of a man as he was, if he wasn't as divinely wise as he was, might give preferential treatment, or at least a greater fair hearing to his allies, to the nobility, to the wealthy elite of Jerusalem, rather than to people, you know, from the farmers, and certainly not to prostitutes. The fact that Shlomo is able to do this and listen with such care and concern and to give them that audience and to judge one versus one without witnesses, it shows his intelligence, it shows his human perception, it shows his ability to solve a case without witnesses, but it shows the ability to treat the lowest of the low with absolute justice. There's never been anybody like that. That's what we aspire to. Shlomo was that. Nobody before or after him ever had such perfect, divinely given justice abilities that it could be absolutely fair. It's what we all strive for, hopefully. But Shlomo made it. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is promising Shlomo, and that's what Shlomo gets it. Here, just to lend further support to this argument, here we run into a little chronological fun. I like this kind of stuff. Shlomo lived before Yeshayahu, who lived before Yirmiyahu, okay? But Sefer Melachim traditionally is written by Yirmiyahu, which is after Yeshayahu, okay? So ride with me on this. Here's what I can tell you with certainty, and then you can work out the chronological circle on your own time. The narratives about Shlomo HaMelech, until he really goes astray at the end with the Avodah Zarah in Perek Yud Aleph, until then, Prakim Gimel through Yud, Shlomo is cast as the ideal messianic king. That's how he's set up. He becomes the prototype for all later messianic visions. Or, the narrative in Sefer Melachim is modeled after all the messianic visions of Yeshayahu and Micha and so on and so forth. That's the chronological circle part. But regardless, Shlomo, by being a prophetic king over a nation that's fully righteous, building the Beit HaMikdash where the Shekhinah occupies it, where there's peace in the land, where everybody's allied with everybody, everything is looking so good, so on and so forth. Everybody's under his fig tree and his vine. That appears in the Melachim narrative. That becomes part of the Messianic visions. All of that is circular, meaning Shlomo is cast as the original Melech HaMashiach, the true ideal king, in the narrative over there. And later on, Messianic visions of the prophets, such as Yeshayahu, Micha, later on Yirmiyahu, and so on, are modeled or become the model for Shlomo HaMelech. That all being said, when we look at one of the classical messianic visions of all time, and that is Yeshayahu Perek Yud Aleph, in source number 3, the Atzachoter Migeza Yishai, there will be some twig or branch that comes from the trunk of Yishai, namely from the Davidic home. Menetzer Mishar Hashav Yifra, well, what would this ideal messianic king be like? Nacha Alav Ruach Hashem, Ruach Chochmah, he will have the Spirit of God, he will have Chochmah, he will have Binah, Ruach Etzau Gvura, Ruach Dat Virat Hashem, a wonderful battery of traits. Baricho Virat Hashem, Lomra Einav Yishpot, he won't just judge with his eyes. Lo Mishma was Nav Yochiach, he will not just judge with his ears. Veshafat Betzerek Galim, he will judge the poorest of the people fairly. Lochiach B'mishor L'Anvei Aretz, and once again, he will bring absolute justice to the poorest of the land. V'ikai Aretz B'shevet Piv Ruach Svatav Yamid Rasha. Yeshayahu, when he wants to talk about what is the most ideal Ruach Elohim and Chochmah possible in this messianic king, the answer is that he judges the poor fairly. Well, that's what Shlomo did. Shlomo had a very high IQ, but more importantly, he was very fair. Yeshayahu realizes that's what a true Melech HaMashiach is all about. This absolute democratic spirit where everybody who stands in trial stands in a fair trial. Just as Shlomo is just Shlomo in front of God, so too, everybody should be a true citizen in front of Shlomo HaMelech. And Midrash Rabbah, in source number 4, plays up a different element of the sitting on the divine throne. In Devarei HaYamim, it says, Shenemar v'yeshev Shlomo al kisei Hashem, he sat on God's throne, Lamelech. Amar v'yizkach v'chiyav shalo l'adam l'yeshev al kisei Hashem. What in the world does that mean, that he's sitting on God's throne? He's on his own throne. Elamah kiso shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu sholed misof ha'olam v'ad sofo, af kiso shel Shlomo sholed misof ha'olam v'ad sofo. Just as God rules the world, so too Shlomo's reign went throughout the entire world. Machisei Hashem dan below edim v'hatra'ah, just as God can judge without witnesses and forewarning. Af kisei Shlomo dan below edim v'hatra'ah, likewise Shlomo is capable of judging without witnesses or forewarning. Be'ezehudzeh, what case are we referring to? Dinin shel zonot, and this is referring to the justice rendered to the prostitutes, hadahu dechtiv, az tavon ashtayim nashim. So this midrash plays up on Shlomo's other element, which is that he was able to render fair justice to prostitutes without even any witnesses. Exactly what Yeshayahu casts as the ideal messianic king. This is his divine wisdom. So just to summarize everything, we've seen a whole battery of interpretations ranging from the Talmudic period through the medieval period and down to the modern period, which continue to go on and on and on in circles. And I think all of that is rooted in just one faulty assumption, and that is that Chochmah means this was the smartest thing that anybody ever did. Shlomo's Chochmat Elohim, and this is what he is praised for as being the greatest ever, is that he was absolutely fair. The elements of judging fairly without witnesses and judging prostitutes specifically fairly without witnesses in this magnificently powerful king's throne room, that really ultimately is what Chochmat Elohim is all about. So I hope that not only is it a fair text analysis of the situation, I hope it's a good lesson to learn about what we should all be aspiring to. Very often children in schools think smarter is better. Smart is good. Not to put it down in any which way, shape, or form. But fair, that's Chochmat Elohim. For people to be able to judge whether it's teachers being fair graders, whether it's children just being able to understand the concept of fairness rather than, one-upmanship based on who you are, what family you come from, and so on and so forth. These are incredibly important lessons for children, and honestly, they're important lessons for adults too. And so I hope that this analysis at least tried to drive home what I believe that Sefer Melachim is ultimately trying to teach. Yes.
But then, in the end, how did he know?
That's not what I think the narrative is answering. In other words, it could be as simple as he knew because of the sword thing. Because he brought out the sword, and in other words, he was willing to gamble that that would work. Not that he knew before, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. That's not the impressive part. The most impressive part of the story is that two prostitutes gained an audience to Shlomo HaMelech, and he gave them a fair trial and solved their case. Regardless of how smart that solution is, and even if there were many smarter court solutions in the history of the world. Yes?
This argument, I think, is pretty compelling. I wonder if any of the questions speak about, which is, if the woman A is telling the truth, then that's the only option she has to do is to appeal to the highest court of justice. If she's lying, then essentially she's running a con game, which depends on her ability to hoodwink the wisest king. And that seems very implausible. And that seems like a compelling argument.
Compelling argument to...
That she's telling the truth.
Because she wouldn't gamble it otherwise.
Yeah.
Could be. It also could be. I don't know if it would be compelling. It's certainly a fair argument. You could make a case that they went to the local courts and she figured she can get away with it. And then it kept getting bumped. And once the process starts, you're stuck. You can't pull out at any given point until ultimately it goes to Shlomo. In other words, I don't assume that the first person to hear their case was Shlomo. I assume it had to work its way up through the local courts, wherever village they came from, and ultimately they came from. I don't know that it's compelling as much as I think you're raising a very reasonable point.
I was just going to say the jails are full of people who think they're smarter than the system.
Right.
Okay, we'll take one last
okay.
one.
Yes.
Downtrodden society, and therefore everything you said is correct, that it's remarkable that Shlomo would listen to people of this. Assuming they're liars because there's a note is not necessary. Women were unprotected in that society, and if you were thrown out by some man who took you and didn't like you and your father didn't want you back because he was some type, you couldn't become a lawyer and you couldn't become a teacher. I mean, you had to eat, and maybe you had children. And so So I don't think to assume that they had evil character and were liars it doesn't sit well with me.
Okay.
You know, that sentence, they had to be liars because they were so noble. They had to be the most pathetic dregs of society because they were so noble. And it is remarkable that those people could get to the king.
Okay, good. Let me just backtrack a little bit. Regardless of cause for why one would enter prostitution for a living, so to speak, and there's no question that throughout the ages there are many who did it because of a downtrodden state, not just in the ancient.
Look what Tamar had to get her justice.
Not just in the ancient period. The point I was trying to make, which I believe is correct, is an excellent article by somebody named Phyllis Berg, a feminist writer who writes about the role of the prostitute in Tanakh. And she plays up this element also, that it's not a matter of all prostitutes are liar. In fact, we know that one of these two is telling the truth. The issue is that because they're so used to not just saying the whole story, they're not giving full disclosure with their customers, that means that they're trained in a way that most people are not to be able to not give full disclosure.
That's different than saying they were Zonote, and so...
That means that if one is lying, Shlomo, they might not seem as agitated. That's all I was trying to say.
All I was objecting to was they were Zonote.
Objection sustained.
Okay, I want to thank you. Before anybody goes, I want to thank you. Angel for coming all this way. I want to thank everyone for coming, and again invite everyone to